Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, we'll be talking with nursing education clinician Mr. Ernest Grant about injuries from burns. And I know this is something that we all want to know more about, basically what to do to keep from getting burned.
Have you ever burned yourself?
Yes, it hurts.
I've burned myself a couple different places. So I suspect this is one of those things that almost every one of our listeners has had a burn at some point in time.
And every time I want to know, what can I do to make this pain go away?
Well, we're going to talk about that today. And we're also going to talk about some research that matters. But we also want to let our listeners know that Your Health is doing some focus groups to help understand better how we can serve listeners like you all out there. And you can earn some extra cash for the holiday season and participate in one of these focus groups if you would like. Christy and I are not conducting them, so you can be honest. And you can visit yourhealthradio.org or email yourhealthunc@gmail.com. That's yourhealthunc@gmail.com if you'd like to participate.
Well, first we're going to talk about some research that matters on our show before we talk about burns. And Adam, the first one's about vitamin E. Do you take vitamin E supplements?
I don't, Christy. I might have taken it at one point in time thinking that it might help my overall health. But years ago, I started reading about problems with it that it maybe caused some more diseases than it might help. And then there was research that says it didn't help a lot of diseases. And this new research makes me even more glad that I stopped it, which is vitamin E and strokes.
Now, this is some research that was from multiple different countries, the U.S., France, and Germany, that reviewed a lot of studies of vitamin E and its effect on stroke.
And we know that vitamin E actually is a blood thinner. And so there's some concern that the type of stroke where there's bleeding involved could actually be worse in people who maybe take vitamin E. And that's what they found.
They did. They found that taking the vitamin increased the risk of hemorrhagic stroke, or the type of stroke that causes bleeding in the brain, whereas it does decrease the risk of ischemic stroke, which is a kind of stroke that happens more from a clot going to the brain.
But the bleeding type of stroke was actually much more risky than the protection by the ischemic stroke. And so this really suggests that you really should have great caution. You know, vitamin E is a drug. It's a vitamin, but it's a drug. And, you know, there are certain amounts you should get naturally, but probably taking a supplement may not actually be helpful, at least uncontrolled widespread use.
Yeah, it certainly may not be as safe as I think a lot of people think. So it should be something you discuss and weigh out with your doctor.
Well, let's talk about then this very next research, which is on colon cancer and the risk of colon cancer with diabetes.
So we've known that there is some increased risk between having type 2 diabetes and an increased risk of colon cancer. But this was studies looking at a lot of different results of many different studies to look at differences potentially between men and women with diabetes.
Yeah, so they followed 180,000 adults for 15 years.
Long time.
They found that men who had type 2 diabetes, but not women, had a greater chance of developing colon cancer, 24% more likely.
And it was really new information that the men are at higher risk, but not the women. And the question is why? And they propose that maybe women with diabetes, because they're gaining better control of their blood sugar, don't have the same risk over time as men who aren't getting as good of control.
Yeah, this article that was in the journal Gastroenterology, that makes sense, really trying to see, well, what should you do with this information? Because maybe some of the drugs that women take,
metformin,
may decrease their risk. But I think this just tells us that, you know, if you have diabetes, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners, Christy, have diabetes, a lot of our patients have diabetes, you really need to pay real attention, particularly if you're a male, of getting your colon cancer screening on time on a regular basis. Because we don't really understand why this risk may be higher, but it suggests everyone should get their colon cancer screening. But certainly, if you have diabetes, pay really good attention to it. That's all I can say. can make of it. I don't know about you.
It doesn't change my recommendations to anyone. I'm recommending to all my patients to get their colon cancer screening, but maybe this gives you that extra kick in the pants to get it done. No pun intended.
Well, speaking of a kick in the pants, our next Research That Matters is about exercise, and we got to get up and get those pants and moving out there, and depression.
Yeah, so there's been some research in the past showing that exercise has an impact on depression. That in a study in 2007, that people who went through group-based exercise therapy did as well in their improvements for depression as those people who took antidepressant drugs. So a lot of promise for exercise for depression, but this was different.
Right, so this looked at kind of the long-term impact. So what happens after patients have done an exercise program and the intervention ends, and they found that depression tends to recur in these patients. And so the authors concluded, and I don't know if I agree, I'll be curious about you, Christy, that exercise may have a short-term benefit on depression, but it doesn't have a long-term benefit. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, it did show that there was a slight improvement of people who are doing the exercise intervention. That the thing it showed that then when they stopped the exercise,
exactly,
that their depression might recur. So to me, it doesn't necessarily say that exercise doesn't work. It just says you should continue it.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, one of the authors of this said, that if exercise was a pill, I don't think the Food and Drug Administration would approve it as an antidepressant. Well, if you stop your antidepressant,
it would stop working too.
It stops working too. So I think the FDA would say, yeah, we approve it, but you got to keep taking that pill. You got to keep taking that exercise pill. You got to have that kick in the pants to keep you moving.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. It's funny. We came to the exact same conclusion. That was an odd conclusion from that author, I thought.
Well, but let's talk about our last study on depression, about depression and teenagers, a really critical issue.
So this was a study looking at 86 depressed teenage males and 110 depressed teenage females ages 12 to 17, and they were assigned to one of four different short-term treatments, a medication, fluoxetine or Prozac, a type of talk therapy that's very common called cognitive behavioral therapy, doing a combination of both, or a placebo.
Yeah, and the good news here is that 95% of these teens got over their initial bout of depression, including the great majority of them within 2 years. But the relapse of depression was common.
It was. And unfortunately, being female was the biggest factor that predicted a relapse in the study. And they also found that people who became who improved sooner during the first treatment course were less likely to have recurrence than those who it took longer to recover from that depression.
Yeah, they didn't really have real reasons why the female teens had more recurrence than the male teens. They thought it might have some self-image issues. I also think that there's a lot on women in general in our society. And also we know that sexual abuse and other sorts of physical abuse for women are much, 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 much higher.
Absolutely.
And that one out of five women have some sort of lifetime sexual or physical abuse. And so maybe a lot of these teens had those kinds of problems.
Those things don't just go away.
They just don't go away here. So
not with a pill.
This is good news, but also caution here. Well, that probably concludes our Research That Matters, but we have had a chance to, I think, cover some really important issues today.
We have. We've talked about vitamin E and potential dangers from taking it.
Yep, about the need to get colon cancer screening for everyone at the right time, but particularly those with diabetes.
About exercise and its potential benefits or questionable long-term benefits for depression.
Yeah, but take that exercise pill even after you're not long depressed. And
Absolutely.
Then also, if you have a teenager that has gone through a bout of depression, be really alert for the possibilities of recurrence.
So that does conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with nursing education clinician Mr. Ernest Grant about injuries from burns. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we are talking about injuries from burns. And as Christy and I mentioned at the top of the show, this is one of those things that, boy, every listener probably has some experience with, unfortunately. But we're really going to talk about what can we do to actually prevent these types of injuries from occurring. And we're really glad that we have Dr. Ernest Grant, otherwise known as Ernie, with us today.
And we would like to welcome you, Ernest Grant. He is the nursing education clinician for the North Carolina J.C. Burn Center, where he has worked for the past 28 years. Mr. Grant serves on lots of national committees that establish the standards of care for burns, and he serves as the president of the North Carolina Nurses Association. Thanks for being with us, Ernie.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
You know, Ernie, one of the things that we, Christy and I, really always want to understand in this case, maybe a story as to how did you get interested in burns? Because, you know, you really are, and I, a listener should know, you are really one of the national heroes. You've received extensive awards for your work in burn prevention and burn education. How did this start, though?
Thank you, Adam, for the opportunity to explain that. Well, you mentioned that we are called the North Carolina J.C. Burn Center, and the JCs are a civic organization, pretty much like the Lions Club or the Rotary Club. And back in 1982, when I moved to Chapel Hill to complete my undergraduate degree, I was a member of the JCs. So I figured, what better place to work than a place that is a charity or a project that your organization supports. So my intent was to only work for about a year and a half while I completed my degree. And 28 years later, I'm still here. So I think I have the best job in the world.
So what do you get to do in your job? I mean, there are lots of people who specialize in burns and treating burns in a hospitalized unit, or it sounds like you're also doing more of a public health related work.
Yes, my role is more of that of an advocate. I like to tell people that my main job is to work my colleagues out of a job by teaching people across the state and teaching healthcare professionals how to prevent burns from occurring. If I'm successful with that, then there wouldn't be any need for the Burn Center at Chapel Hill. However, we know that that's not going to necessarily be the case, but we do know that things that I have done has made a difference. So that's one aspect of my job. Another aspect is to see that when the unfortunate incident of a burn does occur, that the patient does receive the proper pre-hospital care or care at the outlying hospital before they are transferred to us, because it makes such a big difference in their outcome once they have arrived to our facility.
We want to be sure we talk about both of those things, prevention and the early treatment. And as a physician and certainly as a parent, and I'm sure, Adam, you're interested in this too, I want to know what we can do to really prevent it. What have you done that works? My son is obsessed with fire. Mm-hmm. Anywhere we go, if there's a candle, he is drawn to the flame like a moth.
And we have a term for that, Christy.
Pyro.
He's only
three.
We can get him a good therapist.
He's only three. It flickers. Yeah. It concerns me.
Yeah. He's doing what comes natural in that children are very fascinated by fire. And we know that that plays such a big role in our lives, both perhaps in our religious ceremonies and our culture and things of that sort. All of those are some of the aspects with that. The thing to do, though, is teaching kids that that matches and lighters are tools. They're not toys. They're not to be played with by children. These are tools that adults only can use. And so when something like that happens, they need to, if they find matches or toys or lighters, then they need to notify an adult or a grown-up that there's danger around.
Well, you know, Ernie, isn't that, though, a problem? I mean, I know that in the field of work I do with addiction and tobacco, the moment you say it's an adult custom, mm-hmm. boy, that just drives the kids to want to experiment with it. It seems like with this situation that Christy's describing with her child, that you almost have to burn yourself. I mean, you don't want to light a match to say, here, feel how hot it is. But you have to grow respect for this to understand that, don't you?
Yeah, I see what you're saying in that, the only way that they're going to learn, and we have had cases of that over the years where a parent is trying to teach a child what is hot or what it means when they say hot. So they may take a lighter or something and think that they're they're teaching the child a lesson by, you know, burning their fingers.
No, we don't want that to happen.
Don't advertise. Yeah,
no.
Do not advocate that. The safest thing, obviously, is if you're going to have anything like matches or lighters, to please lock those in a cabinet where a child cannot get to those. That's going to be the best thing, is just keep them out of sight, out of mind, and that way we'll greatly reduce the possibility that an injury may occur.
Well, you know, you have let's just start with one real quick basic. Review real quickly. First, second, third degree burns. That's the terminology I was taught coming into medical school, and I still think that way. Do I need to grow up?
No. That is still used interchangeably. Obviously, in the healthcare world, we use different things, but a first degree burn is similar to what we call a superficial burn. It just burns the first layer of skin.
Kind of like a sunburn?
Like a sunburn, absolutely. Usually it's going to heal in about a week to 10 days.
And the skin will peel?
The skin will peel. It should heal. The skin goes back to being natural. The most important thing there is, of course, depending on how involved the sunburn may be, obviously good hydration, drinking plenty of fluids, usually sometimes at the beginning of that, something like Gatorade or some other electrolyte-containing solution if it's a really severe sunburn. Usually over-the-counter products will work very well to also help to ease the pain and discomfort that the person may be experiencing. And using a something such as ibuprofen will help also cut down on the inflammation so that the damaged skin will heal that much faster. And then applying, once it begins to peel, applying some non-alcohol-based lotion such as Eucerin or Keri lotion works very, very well to help keep that skin moist so that it doesn't itch, because if it itches, which is a good sign, it's a sign of it's healing, but we also have the tendency to want to scratch it. And by scratching, that's going to set up the potential for infection, because we all have very dirty nails.
So what about that second degree burn? You know, that water that I accidentally poured the boiling water and I got some blisters.
Right. That is pretty much the hallmark of a second degree burn, is the fact that you do have blisters that have formed. The question is to pop or not to pop the blisters. We always advise that you leave the blisters intact as best as you can, because that's nature's own little bandage. To wrap it in a clean, dry dressing. Using, if it's a small blister or burn, say to about the size of a quarter or so, keeping it wrapped, continuing to watch it, watch for signs of infection. If there's redness that is extending beyond that, then they would probably need to seek medical attention just to make sure that it's not getting an infection.
And I know we're going to have to take a break, but I'd love to hear quickly about third-degree burns and just what they are and what we should do initially.
Very quickly, third-degree burns are ones which burn much deeper into the skin. They usually have a pearly white or khaki color in appearance. There's usually no pain associated with a third-degree burn as there is with a second-degree burn. And, again, that would require medical attention as quickly as possible.
It's worse because you've burned the nerves.
Right. You've burned through the nerves.
It's not a better thing that there's no pain.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we're going to need to take a short break. We're talking with Mr. Ernest Grant, Community Outreach Coordinator, past president of the North Carolina Nurses Association, all around expert on burns, and we're looking forward to continuing that conversation. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Mr. Ernest Grant about injuries from burns, and we talked a little bit about first, second, and third degree burns, and certainly needing to get medical care for a third degree burn. But we talked at the top a little bit about your public health work and about things we can do to prevent burns, keeping children safe from matches and lighters. But as we're entering winter, I would imagine, and I certainly know, that we have more burns from heaters, from things that we do in the home to make a fire. Speak to us about what we can do on a public health level to prevent that.
Great. Thank you for that, the opportunity to do that. Obviously, with perhaps the fact that people may be using a fireplace, you know, these certainly do provide adequate warmth and heat. However, as we talked about at the beginning of the hour, children may be fascinated by fire. So generally, we ask that the parents set up a what we call a fire safety zone. That is blocking everything or have nothing close to a fireplace or any open flames by 3 feet. Even if they're using a kerosene heater, you know, make sure that there's a safe distance of at least 3 feet all surrounding all the way around that. So that, again, it reduces the possibility of someone either accidentally bumping into a kerosene heater or getting too close to a fireplace and catching their clothing on fire if some of the sparks were to shoot out and things of that sort.
What about the whole issue of things that can ignite you inside the home? You mentioned, you know, obviously the kerosene heaters and doing those, but what about like space heaters that are electric heaters or even things like computers, laptops? I mean, what are the risks of all the different sorts of things that we have to think about?
Yeah, all of those stand a really great risk of the possibility of starting a fire as well. Particularly when we're dealing with electrical appliances, it may depend upon how relatively new the individual's house may be. A lot of the older homes, you know, because of the type of electrical wiring that was used 15, 20, 30 years ago, they may not necessarily be able to provide enough good support for newer appliances that we have, such as those little small ceramic heaters. They have a really high energy pull. One of the things the homeowner should do is constantly, obviously, check the cords for any fraying. If the cords feel very hot to touch, then they should not use that appliance. Actually, unplug it and obviously get it looked at, or you know, get their electrical wiring looked at as well. Electrical fires are, you know, probably our third most common type house fire cause that we see during the, particularly during the winter months, because people are indoors, they are using those appliances more, and as a result of that, if they do have faulty wiring, that could very easily start a fire within the walls that they may not be able to notice until later on.
We would be remiss to have this conversation with Adam and with you without talking about cigarettes. I would imagine that is a very common cause of fires in the home.
Yes, yeah. It is. And fortunately, North Carolina, well, back in 2007, did something that was very remarkable in that our state legislature did pass what we call the Fire Safe Cigarette Legislation. These are cigarettes that are designed to self-extinguish or reduce the potential of a fire from happening. They will go out if they are not inhaled upon. And obviously, since we have adopted that particular legislation, that legislation has also been adopted now in all 50 states of the U.S. One of the things, however, that we have to be cautious of is that we are beginning to see a number of counterfeit cigarettes that do not meet that standard that are being sold in various states. And so we have to be very vigilant that only the fire-safe cigarettes are being sold in North Carolina. And one of the best ways that the consumer can look at that, if they still choose to smoke, is to look on the carton there or on the box of the cigarettes. They should see the letters FSC, which essentially stands for fire-safe cigarette, and they would be assured of knowing that that cigarette has been manufactured to the standard that would reduce the potential of a fire happening.
And we should really mention, I had the pleasure of working with Ernie, who really is a statewide and national leader of this effort. And North Carolina, when it passed this, was on the early side of many of these states. But it doesn't remove the entire risk of cigarettes. So
no,
we call them fire safe, which
right.
is really
it's
fire safer.
Yes,
right.
It is fire safer.
Because cigarettes
best thing
still cost.
Do is
yeah.
not smoke. And then the next best thing you could do is smoke somewhere away and put it out immediately.
Right.
And the last best thing you could do along with that is smoke one of these safer type of cigarettes, which
correct.
Is a misnomer, huh?
Correct. Absolutely.
And so we've got the number one and the three most frequent calls. What's number two in there? We left one out somewhere.
Yeah. Number two would be a house fire that may be related to cooking or unattended cooking. Mm-hmm. You know, frequently, you know, people will get distracted while they're cooking in the kitchen. Maybe there's a pan of grease or something on the stove while they're waiting for that to heat up. They get on the phone or they get distracted and they go back into the kitchen and there's a fire has occurred. Obviously, one of the things that we always advocate is remain in the kitchen the whole time that your stove is on and obviously keeping young children away from such appliances while you are cooking, so that it does create a safe environment as well.
You know, Ernie, I must mention, I don't think I've ever mentioned this on the air to Christy, that my actually house growing up burned down that way.
Oh, wow. Hmm.
The house I grew up in, we were outdoors with a party, and someone had kept the stove on with some grease, and all of a sudden people were saying, oh, wow, what's that fire coming out of the roof? not a good thing. Thank goodness no one was inside there, but it sounds like that can cause many fires.
Yeah.
I do want to talk about smoke detectors. So, I mean, we've got the kind of smoke detectors that are set up to the alarm that'll try to make it go off.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also got some smoke detectors that keep beeping. You know, that annoying, it's driving me crazy.
And
I really want to go.
They're 16 feet up in the air.
Yeah. Yes. I really want to go and just knock them all out and say, I'm not going to have a fire.
Change the battery.
Getting me. What do we know about the importance of smoke detectors and why I probably should not
go crazy?
Yes.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. The first thing I want to say is that by having a working smoke alarm, and notice I'm using that term, working smoke alarm, it will increase your chance of surviving a house fire by greater than 80%. Smoke alarms also, a lot of people may not be aware, but they're only good for about 10 years. So if you have one in your house that is older than that, then you need to replace it with a newer smoke alarm. The beeping that you're hearing obviously is indicating that the batteries are low and that you need to replace the batteries in there. And indeed, just last week when we changed our clock, there is the mnemonic that we like for people to think about: change your clock, change your battery. Since we're going into the colder winter months, you change the clock back. You should also remember to change the batteries in your smoke alarm. The newer smoke alarms, one of the things that again, this is something I've helped to advocate on the national front, is they take a different type of battery. One of the things that we saw in the patients that I've cared for over my 28 years here at the Burn Center has been the fact that people, kids will have a little toy that needed a 9-volt battery. Well, where's the best place to get one? You know, you get on a ladder and take the battery out of the smoke alarm because you don't think that that it is working. And unfortunately, when they do that, then they are essentially taking the fireman out of the picture. I like to think of a smoke alarm as the firefighter that lives in your home, because it's going to be the first thing to alert you to the possibility that a fire may be happening. And most fires in North Carolina, most house fires, most deadly house fires are going to occur usually from 10 at night till 6 in the morning when we're sleeping. Hmm. And so having that working smoke alarm is so vital. That we know that it is working properly.
So, Christy, you're going to need to go home and find out when that sound goes off.
Yes.
If the children have taken the battery out, or your husband's replaced the battery, because either one.
Well, but also a plan. So, I mean, a plan at night when it does go off of what am I going to do if I'm separated
absolutely.
In the house. So, we should talk about some.
Last thing that we could probably talk about is give us how do you recommend this exit plan? Because I had never thought about that, and I used to live in this house that we were on the second level, and it wasn't so easy.
Yes. Well, and let me also just add that regarding a smoke alarm, there should be one, at least a minimum of one, on every level of the home, and also one inside the sleeping quarters, again, because you want that early warning that it's going to provide, as opposed to if it's somewhere else or if it is disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
When the alarm does go off, we also practice or encourage people to practice what we call an exit drill. You have fire drills at school. The chances of you're having a fire at school is very, very slim. However, the chances of you're having a fire at home is greatly increased. So what I always advocate is that when you have, for the kids, if you have a fire drill at school, you should tell your parents you want to have a fire drill at home that evening. And that way everyone knows what to do. They know what the sound of a smoke alarm sounds like. They know what to do when the alarm goes off, how they're going to get out, and one central meeting place. We encourage never going back in for a pet or for money or for any valuables. All of that can be replaced, but you can't replace your life. So everyone should practice what to do and where the central meeting place may be. If there is a person who's too young, say if there's an infant in the home, then the parents or someone that they designate should be the person responsible for getting that individual to safety. Another thing that a lot of people really don't think of is when you have visitors that come over, since the holidays are coming up and people may be visiting for several days, They need to also know what your escape plan is and also how to practice that. So I know when I have guests to stay at my house, we always go over the fire safety information. And that way I just feel more secure that in the event that a fire were to happen, they know what to do as well.
That's really great advice. Great.
Well, speaking of an exit plan, we're going to have to unfortunately exit this this conversation. But we really need to thank Mr. Ernest Grant, Community Health, Public Health, Burn Prevention Extraordinaire for the JC's Burn Center and the UNC Burn Center. Thank you so much for being a great guest with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We'll take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll answer questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend some time talking about your health questions and concerns.
Send us your comments and questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Julie Steiner, to read us our very first house call.
I'm in my 20s, and I tore my ACL and MCL and got an avulsion fracture of my tibia. I was wondering if you had any suggestions as to the best doctor to do my surgery.
Ouch. I'm sorry.
Sounds
painful.
You're empathizing with him, Christy. I'm thinking this must be a doctor who uses medical jargon here. This must be a doctor who got injured and was or a healthcare person. ACL, MCL, avulsion fracture, tibia. A lot of words in there. What are all those words?
Yeah, well, those are some ligaments in your knee that and a little part of the bone of your lower leg that were probably injured doing some sorts of sports activity.
Yeah. Now we can be empathetic.
Yeah. It sounds like it hurts.
And, you know, what's interesting is that there was some recent surgery that said if you just had this ACL injury and you're not a championship athlete, that not all of those actually need to have surgery. So, you know, I'm not saying that you don't need to have surgery, but we should let our listeners know that and remind them that not all of these do need surgery.
And we're fortunate to be in an area with a lot of great doctors, and I don't have a specific name or recommendation other than that if you have seen someone and you feel like you have a relationship with that person, have asked around, they've got the right credentials, I mean, I don't know that some of it you have to go with your gut. It's a risk to let somebody take you under the knife, but we're fortunate to have a lot of great people around.
Yeah, Christy and I haven't been paid enough by any one doctor to mention their name here on the show, but we know that there's some great orthopedic doctors who do work on the knees at UNC. We know there's a great department at Duke. There's some great private practitioners. We tend to refer most of our patients to people we know and work with, and that's
at
the
UNC.
People at the University of North Carolina. But, you know, go with someone who you know and meet. Go meet them first and hear what your friends have to say about them and find out what their success rate is and complication rates, and then go with what you believe will best get you up and out soon.
And it sounds like you have a lot of motivation to get back to your to 100%, as you say. So we wish you the best and hope you'll be really follow through well with the physical therapy after the surgery, which is extremely important.
Yep.
Julie, what do we have next?
I'm 60 years old and have suffered from face pain for 5 years. I went to an ENT specialist who told me to take antibiotics several times and then later said he could find nothing wrong. Last time I went to him, he simply said I needed to live with the pain. So I went to another ENT specialist who said that he thought it was TMJ, and he referred me to a TMJ specialist. This has made a huge difference. 2 months later, and several interventions, my pain level is 75% lower for the first time in 5 years.
Wow.
That's a success story and one of perseverance where you kept going and did not accept no for an answer.
And it makes us happy to hear a patient empowered because, you know, that's what we're trying to do with our show, Christy, is help people feel empowered to, if you're not getting what you need, you're not with the answer you like, then find a different answer and, you know, and push yourself and push others you know, to help you, because this was not an easy diagnosis necessarily.
Right. And in this case, it took a second, third, fourth opinion to get what you needed and then have the interventions that, that then did relieve your pain. So, I mean, it's a wonderful story. We're glad that you're not hurting the way that you were and that you really were empowered to get what you need.
Yeah. I think neither Chrissy or I really like the answer, even though it sometimes is the answer that you're going to have to live with your pain. Sometimes that is the answer that people need to have, but that's really after we've exhausted all efforts to really find out what's going on and if there's anything that we can do to really relieve it. And in this case, there was something treatable.
Yep. Julie, what do we have next?
How do I know if I have gout? I have lots of pain in my feet, and while my doctor said she didn't think it was gout because my uric acid level was not high, I've heard that you can still have gout. I would appreciate your thoughts.
Well, you're going to get our thoughts.
Yeah.
Whether you appreciate it or not, we're going to give you our thoughts. That's what we do here. What are your first thoughts,
well,
Chrissy?
I guess we should start with what is gout. And that is really an arthritis that happens due to having uric acid in your blood, maybe too much of it, that causes crystals in a joint. It's usually the big toe, but it can happen other places. And those crystals in your joint can make it hot and red and extremely painful. And that, in essence, is what gout is.
Yeah, and you can get it from making too much of that uric acid, kind of like you're a genetic hyperproducer. Mm-hmm. Doesn't sound very good. Or maybe your kidneys don't get rid of it enough because you have kidney disease. So lots of different reasons why you could have a gout at your age at 60 years old. Well, actually, we don't know this age, do we? That was our last one. So, but if you are older, you know, 30, 40, 50, that certainly can happen here as we get older. Drugs can also do this too, raise the uric acid level.
Mm-hmm. And it's more common in people who have high blood pressure or other medical problems. Can be brought on by alcohol as well.
But the pain in your feet, this could be gout. I mean, you know, it's one of those things that we think of. But, you know, maybe with the uric acid being low, that certainly lowers the chance, but it doesn't remove the chance, does it?
It's true. Gout can happen in people who have uric acid levels that aren't that high. And you can also have high uric acid levels and never get gout. Although
well,
you're at higher risk for it.
We've cleared this one up.
Yeah, about clear as mud. So that one uric acid level is not the end-all be-all for the diagnosis.
And one thing that could be done is an x-ray of the foot to see if there's any erosion of the bone that may go along with gout. And if you've got fluid in the foot, maybe even getting a little part of that fluid and looking at it under a microscope.
Yep. So if you're not satisfied with the answer, go back to your doctor and say, I really think this might be gout. Explain it to me a little further.
Yep. Julie, what's our very last house call?
My daughter is in college and has a mild case of scoliosis, which causes her to have occasional back pain. She just called me in tears because she said her back is now constantly hurting her. She says that sitting isn't so bad, but when she stands up to move, it really hurts. It took her 15 minutes to get out of bed yesterday because she was trying to find the best position to move without hurting. She's going to go to the school health center soon. Unfortunately, she can't come home this weekend to see her regular doctor because she has exams.
Well, I have several different thoughts about that. First of all, I'm sorry your daughter is suffering, and it must be hard for you to be farther away and not be able to kind of take her in and care for her in the way that maybe you want to as a mom. And I can imagine that would be difficult.
Yeah, actually, any parent, because as a father, I would be equally concerned here, Chrissy.
Not to diss on fathers.
And I'll be curious what you have to say here. But, you know, I also wonder if what else is going on here? Because, you know, mild scoliosis doesn't really cause the types of problems clinically, in my experience, Chrissy, that causes someone to have this pain. And so I oftentimes wonder, there's a lot more maybe going on here in a child that's away in college. And, you know, what's going on
right
here?
Right during the time of exams, it is.
There's stress going on here. Is there any drugs that are happening here that she's taking either prescribed or not?
Mm-hmm. But I would also say that if she's someone who has frequent bouts of trouble with her back, as it sounds like, that maybe she needs to have a relationship with a doctor closer to school where she can get in with that person and not need to get home to see her other doctor.
Right. There's a friend of mine who has a child is at college, and we found an excellent orthopedist physician up there, or and hopefully a really good primary care physician, and hopefully the student health. What you need to be get on the phone with that doctor and clinician in student health and have a long conversation with them about how to work with your daughter.
Yeah. So, I mean, hopefully she'll get in with somebody close and she'll start to develop some strategies of how to prevent back pain and how to manage it initially without maybe needing to suffer for so long.
And hopefully she doesn't have to live with it, as we talked about in another patient.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Christy, that probably concludes our house calls. We've had a chance to talk about maybe finding a good doctor for knee injuries and the back pain that you just mentioned.
And what else have we talked about?
About gout,
how
to treat gout in the feet and diagnose it and the role of the uric acid level. And then finally, the patients that might find a diagnosis when someone else says they have to live with it, like TMJ, temporomandibular joint dysfunction.
Being an empowered patient. Well, we thank you for joining us for Your Health, and we hope that we've addressed some issues that are important to you and your health. And we want you to write us. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can call us at 919-966-8081. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter.
And if you would like to also participate in a focus group, Christy, we are doing focus groups done by students at the UNC School of Public Health to help us better understand your health. For our listeners, you can participate in a focus group and actually earn a little bit extra cash. Visit yourhealthradio.org or email yourhealthunc@gmail.com if you're interested.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Ernest Grant. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of UNC Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Pate.
And we'll talk to you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.